Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for joining us for the final installment, thank you, of our pre-Shavuos Aseret HaDibros lecture series. We've been speaking about the second of the Aseret HaDibros, Lo Yi Elecha Elohim Acherim. The second Dibra addresses matters pertaining to Avodah Zarah. And our topic tonight is scientific atheism, the modern world's Avodah Zarah. Is scientific atheism the modern world's Avodah Zarah? Let me introduce our topic tonight, like I did last time, with a bit of a personal anecdote story. This is actually not a fully personal anecdote. It did not happen to me personally. It happened to a friend of mine, a longtime chavrusa of mine, currently a magid shir in Eretz Yisrael, who shared with me the following story when he was that transpired during his YU years. So one time, he was going to a friend's wedding somewhere upstate. Perhaps it was even in Canada, I don't remember, but they were driving a long way to get to this wedding, and they decided they were going to make a stop in New Square just to grab some breakfast, just to grab some food before they made their way up to the wedding. So they sit down in one of the local bagel stores, and they are having their bagels together. They are eating. And as they are doing so, a chassid sits down at the table next to them, and they're discussing whatever they're discussing, whatever the latest in YU politics is, whatever is happening in the Beis Medrash, outside the Beis Medrash. And this gentleman, this Jew, overhears they are from Yeshiva University, which piques his interest. And he says, is it true that I heard that you're from Yeshiva University? And they said, yes. He says, what do they teach in Yeshiva University? They start explaining again. It's a bit of a mystery. If you're not in the YU world, what exactly YU is, it's a bit of a mystery. So they say, we spend a lot of our time learning Torah. That's our primary focus, of course. And in addition, we study all sorts of different things, all sorts of different secular wisdom as well. And he says to them, do they teach evolution in Yeshiva University? That was the question that he posed. Now, none of my friends were bio majors. None of them were pre-med either. And they sensed that something was a little bit off. So they said, I'm not sure. We don't really take biology classes. I don't really know. They were kind of just trying to dodge the question, not really sure what exactly they teach in those courses. Then he goes a step further. He says, do you believe in evolution? And they were also able to tell that by the way he was using the word believe, let's say believe with a capital B, he was not asking a question about the theory of the origin of species. He was asking something much, much larger. So once again, they really just dodged the question. They said, yeah, I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who's a biologist or something like that. I'm not really sure. Then he said to them, well, I want to tell you guys something. I believe in evolution. I don't believe in God, he says to them. I don't really believe in any of this Torah and mitzvot that we do. He says, look, I'm a part of the community, so I keep the garb, and I want my family to be comfortable, and I don't want to harm my children's shidduch prospects, so I don't really talk about it with anyone inside of the community. But he said he went on for a good 5-10 minutes about how he thinks that all the yesodos, all the fundamental ikarei emuna, all the pillars of our belief, from his standpoint, are not true. And really, he buys into evolution and a scientific worldview. And that is the view that he himself adopts in life. And they said a few minutes later, he got up and his family had come by. He joined his family, a classic Hasidisha family. You never would have known from the outside that he had this internal struggle of faith going on. But that is, and it was jarring to them to see that. And he went on his way, and they were kind of left trying to contextualize what exactly had transpired, this whole conversation that they had with somebody who outwardly looked quite religious, but inwardly had really lost his faith to what he labeled evolution. And there's really a lot to unpack from that story. But I think one of the things that I want to talk about tonight is the difference between what I would call science as a discipline versus science as a faith. I didn't ask the question as to whether science is today's modern day Avodah Zarah. Science is one of the most impressive accomplishments that humanity has to boast, certainly outside the world of Torah, outside the world of Torah values and refinements, or just general moral values. Science is perhaps humanity's single greatest achievement. You know, the fact that we can explore the outer reaches of the solar system and beyond, the fact that modern medicine has the ability to cure illnesses and diseases that were fatal for most of humanity's history. I think there's really little more that society has achieved that is more impressive than science. And that's what I'm calling science as a discipline, that the discipline of exploring the natural world around us, exploring how it works, exploring in many instances, or taking the additional step of trying to discover how we can utilize the principles of science for the betterment of society and humanity at large. That is one area that we refer to as science. But there's also something that I would call science as faith, where that scientific endeavor has been expanded to many things that are really beyond the confines of narrow scientific exploration and discovery, and have come to take on a broader meaning that is often called science by its proponents, but really means something much, much different, something much, much larger, and is often antithetical to what we believe, as well as not deriving directly from the science as discipline itself, even though they happen to go by the same name. So what I want to talk about tonight is not the question of Torah and how it relates to the discipline of science, of scientific exploration. That does raise certain questions. Perhaps the most famous example of that is cosmology, the question of the age of the universe. By modern cosmological estimates, the universe is approximately 14 billion years old, and a surface reading of the Torah, a basic reading of the Torah, would give you the impression that the Earth is roughly 6,000 years old. It may be the correct conclusion that it's 6,000 years old. How do you reconcile those two things? How do you deal with the scientific evidence that it's 14 billion years old and the impression that it's 6,000 years old? That's a fair question. It's a worthy question. It's something that we can explore at another time. And as you might expect, there are lots of different ways of trying to resolve that tension, but it's not what I want to focus on tonight. Instead, what I want to focus on tonight is Torah and scientific faith, the tension between scientific faith and Torah, which I think is a far more profound tension, and one that I think should bother us much less, but I think it often bothers us much more. In other words, if Torah had a conflict with the actual scientific discipline, that would be something rather disturbing in light of how impressive science is and all that science has accomplished in the world and for humanity and the universe. Fortunately, I think that the tension that exists between scientific discipline and Torah is usually surface tension that you can quite easily resolve. When we talk about scientific faith, we're talking about what I would call almost a religion, a faith system that labels itself science, but really, again, is distinct from scientific discipline. And there's far greater tension between the proponents of scientific faith and the ideology that they often project and the ideology that we hold dear, the ideology of Torah u'mitzvos. And again, I don't think we should be bothered by that, but sometimes it does, largely because of the confluence between these two terms. We tend to mistake scientific faith for scientific discipline, scientific practice as well. And I think we just need to be equipped and know how to properly respond. Tonight, you know, we called this our final shiur. It's what you'd more call in a yeshiva, more of a shmuz or a sicha. I didn't give out Mari Makomos, but I do want to talk about it because I think it is very important. And we're going to do so under the, as our charge for tonight, will be the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Yadalad, which charges us Da Masha Tashav Apikores, that you have to know what to respond to challenges to faith. Rav Volchenstein, I always quote, when I quote this Mishnah, what Rav Volchenstein used to say, he would say that Da Masha Tashav Apikores doesn't actually mean Mr. Apikores who happens to live down your block, but it also perhaps means the Apikores that lurks within all of us. All of us have some Yetzer Hara, some remnant of the primordial Nachash who's constantly trying to whisper in our ear and guide us astray. We need to know how to respond to that apikores as well. I'll point out my own diuk on the Mishnah. Very often the Mishnah is quoted as da mal lehashiv in the infinitive. Don't know what you should to respond or know what to respond la apikores. You'll allow me to darshan for a moment. The actual language of the Mishnah is da mashet tashiv la apikores. Know what you will respond. In other words, it's not a theoretical that it might come up at some point, and should it come up at some point, know what to say in that instance. Know what you will say, Mishnah says, because inevitably there will be instances when all of us, and certainly when it comes to scientific atheism, which is so deeply permeated much of the culture around us, there inevitably will be instances when we are called upon to respond. And I want to, again, document the phenomenon and talk about what some of our responses should be over the course of tonight. Before we get into the topic, I want to once again acknowledge our series sponsors. I want to thank the Millers for sponsoring in memory of Ruchi Sharetz, Aleha Shalom, her neshama should have an aliyah. Now, what do I mean, science as faith? So here I want to quote to you a passage from a preface to a book called Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. This is a book by Dr. Alvin Plantinga. Dr. Alvin Plantinga is one of, if not the single most influential philosopher of religion in the last 50 to 100 years. And he wrote a book on the relationship between science, religion, and naturalism. When he says naturalism, he uses that to mean what I am calling science as a faith, science as a religion. It's really a remarkable book. If anybody is interested in the topic, it is intended for lay audiences. I wouldn't call it light reading, but it is at least accessible reading, as opposed to the works that he writes for other philosophers, which are virtually impenetrable. But in the preface, he writes the following. Naturalism, and naturalism, by the way, again, I don't want to get into the nuances right now. Naturalism is a particular branch of atheism. It's not the only form of atheism, although it is probably the most commonly held view of atheism. I wouldn't even say it's the most philosophically sophisticated version of atheism, but naturalism is a form of atheism. Again, the nuances we won't get into so much right now. But he says naturalism is what we would call a worldview, a sort of total way of looking at ourselves and our world. It isn't clearly a religion. The term religion is vague, and naturalism falls into the vague area of its application. Still, naturalism plays many of the same roles as a religion. So Plantinga, because he's a philosopher, is stopping short of saying what I'm saying. He's not calling it a religion. I'm saying perhaps it does rise to the level of religion. At the very least, he's saying it fills the role that many religions play. In particular, it gives answers to the great human questions. Is there such a person as God? How should we live? Can we look forward to life after death? What is our place in the universe? How are we related to other creatures? Naturalism gives answers here. There is no God, and it makes no sense to hope for life after death. As to our place in the grand scheme of things, we human beings are just another animal with a peculiar way of making a living. Naturalism isn't clearly a religion, but since it plays some of the same roles as a religion, we could properly call it a quasi-religion. And very often this view of naturalism, which does not derive from science itself, there are many of the greatest scientists who, as we'll document as we go along, were actually religious believers. But many believers in naturalism argue that their worldview derives naturally from the scientific endeavor itself, and that anyone who is scientifically sophisticated will buy into this view of naturalism. Now, this view of naturalism is not just a belief system, but what Plantinga does not point out in this particular passage, he goes on to document some of this in later passages in the book, is that its proponents begin to act like religious fanatics as well. Now, being a religious fanatic certainly has a negative connotation. If you just mean somebody who is very, very devoted to their religion, we don't view that as a negative thing. We view that as a positive thing. But certainly, if you'd ask the average naturalist if religious fanaticism is a bad thing, they would tell you that it certainly is. And they don't often realize that they exhibit some of those very self-same traits as people that they would label to be fanatical, people that they would label fundamentalists. And what you find often is that this science as faith takes on the broader trappings of religion. It has its saints and its sinners, its believers and its heretics. It has its dogma and insistence on loyalty to dogma. And it insists on throwing out anybody who deviates from it. Let me give you a few examples that are, again, documented. Some of them are documented in this book. Some of them are just from the broader culture, pertaining to areas where science as faith clearly takes hold in a way that science purely as an intellectual discipline could not. There's a guy named Michael Behe who wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. It was published in 1996 by the Free Press. And Behe himself was an evolutionary biologist, but he raised certain questions regarding the completeness of the theory and if it could really explain everything in terms of the origin of life and the diversity of life as we have observed it on this planet. In particular, again, I don't want to get into the weeds or the details here. The book is mostly about the concept of irreducible complexity. What constitutes irreducible complexity and is there irreducible complexity in life and what would be the ramifications of that? In effect, it's a book that challenges some of the traditional Darwinian narrative when it comes to evolution. Some of the responses were just legitimate critical responses that you would expect whenever somebody is promulgating a new scientific theory, particularly when someone is questioning a central scientific theory that really stands as one of the pillars of how the scientific world perceives the universe today, or at least, at the very least in this case, life, at least the way it perceives life on this planet. But other responses went well beyond measured scientific response and exhibited all the outrage that one would exhibit if a sacred tenet was somehow violated. Here, I'll quote to you a response from Peter Atkins. Peter Atkins is an English chemist. And this response was quoted in this book. I draw it from the same source material. He wrote the following. Despite Dr. Behe's training as a scientist, and he acknowledges that he was trained as a scientist, it wasn't just some average Joe writing a book about evolutionary biology. Despite Dr. Behe's training as a scientist, he has been brought up in a religious milieu where answers by instant gratification are the norm. So the problem is he's religious, and therefore he seeks instant gratification. His view is silly, lazy, ignorant, and intellectually abominable. He deserts reason, instead invoking that first resort of the intellectually challenged, that is God. Now, again, that's not a measured response to his arguments. It doesn't take a look at his arguments and say, here's where the problems are, and this is why I, as a chemist, again, speaking in the name of Atkins, or why the establishment view or the mainstream view among evolutionary biologists is that Darwinian theory does work. It's just a bunch of cheap shots and a bunch of just really nasty rhetoric attacking religion as the source of the problem. Again, without realizing that I think there's a certain fanaticism implicit in the vehemence of the response. Planning of commenting on this response says, he says, some of the reaction to Bay's work on the part of the scientific community, rivaling as it does the irrationality of extremist political discourse, would make a fascinating case study in the sociology of science. What he is pointing out is that, again, this is not a scientific debate. At a certain point, it's clearly a debate about sacred principles that some hold to be sacred and dear, that they hold the Darwinian principles to be a matter of sacred dogma, of central beliefs. We have our Ikare Emuna, and Lahavdil Elaf Alfei Avdalos, they have their Ikare Emuna. And while they would not acknowledge that, they would not perceive their belief in those principles as, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to fix the Zoom. While they would not believe in those principles as religious principles, as a matter of faith, they would call them matters of intellect and evidence and the like. The way they often treat them and relate to them is purely as a matter of faith. Those are the central tenets or principles of their religion, of scientific atheism as a faith. It pertains to internal matters of science as well, not even challenging the broader narrative, but simply offering alternative models. Again, I don't want to get too much in the weeds of evolutionary biology here, but there was famously a revisionist view of evolution that was promoted by, among others, a paleontologist named Dr. Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was an atheist. He was not a friend of religion. He had an interesting view of faith that was probably more positive towards it than some other prominent contemporary atheists. He had this famous essay, which he coined the phrase non-overlapping magisteria, that science and religion occupy two different worlds and they don't really conflict with each other. I think it's in certain ways valuable, in other ways an oversimplification of a complex topic. But within the world of evolutionary biology, one of the theories that he was known for was challenging the classic Darwinian knowledge of model of evolution and proposing an alternate model. Again, in very brief, the traditional Darwinian model says that over time, gradually, species diverge. And we know that that's true on an individual species level. But Darwin thought that was true for phyla as well, that the difference between us and a sea sponge is the result of very slow changes that gradually happen over the course of time. And it's through that phyletic gradualism that ultimately you have radically different species. A human being and a cockroach are different because of those gradual changes. And he argued, based on certain paleontological discoveries in Canada, in the Burgess Pass, I think it's called the Burgess, I don't know if the pronunciation is correct, but he argued that that was not actually the model and that really evolution worked through a different type of model, dynamic equilibrium. He basically had a different model from Darwin's original model. And the response was, once again, just vehemence. Like, how could you betray the sacred principles that Avinu, that Darwin has introduced to the world and has promoted to us? How can you, as an evolutionary biologist, almost betray that sacred trust? And I use the word sacred here deliberately, obviously facetiously as well. I don't view it as sacred, but from their standpoint, almost sacred trust of what the model needs to be. And I think it's once again reflective of how, even within just alternate models of how things can work, there's this pervasive mentality of loyalty, fealty to certain central principles that you'd expect somebody who values intellectual exploration to be willing to question. That is, after all, the entire premise of modern science: follow the empirical evidence, follow the evidence wherever it may lead. But very often, I think practitioners don't necessarily live up to that creed because of these deeply held, almost sacred religious beliefs that they hold. And recently, you've just seen it increase. In 2022, there was a headlines were made when a professor at NYU named Jonathan Haidt quit the Society for Personality and Social Psychology. Now, Jonathan Haidt is a psychologist. So here we're not talking about the natural sciences, to be clear. We're talking about the social sciences. The social sciences are certainly a step removed from the natural sciences. It's not the same as physics or chemistry. I often say that my brother, who's now studying to be a psychologist, so he deeply values psychology, but he likes to quip that when he was in college, every single one of his psychology courses started with a discussion of why psychology is a science. And he felt it was the most self-defeating argument. He said, do you think they start every physics course with why physics is a science? They don't actually do that. So again, so this is social sciences, not natural sciences, and they are certainly different. But Haight decided to quit the Society for Personality and Social Psychology because they required, before you presented any research, a statement on how your research contributes to equity, inclusion, and anti-racism goals. And if you wanted to present your research, you needed to first make a declaration of how you are going to contribute to those goals. Now, to be very clear, Haight himself is a pretty liberal guy in the old sense of the term liberalism. I don't know if he would identify with the new contemporary left, but he's traditionally a very liberal personality. And he's not the type to have any qualms with the efforts of equity and inclusion. He did take issue with the replacement of the word diversity. It was originally equity, inclusion, and diversity. They replaced diversity with anti-racism, and that's also a very loaded term. So on substance, he took issue with that one thing, the replacement of those terms. But in terms of the broader substance, he was somebody who's very promotional of the values of equity, inclusion, and diversity. He thinks those are wonderful things, that we should promote them in our society. He's not the type to protest on the merits of the cause itself. What he did protest was the fact that in order to present your scientific research, before you even present your scientific research, you need to declare that it is somehow going to head towards, contribute towards those goals. And he felt that doing so compromises the scientific endeavor. The whole point of the scientific endeavor, in his word, is truth. His primary loyalty when he conducts research is truth. And if it contributes to those goals, then he would be overjoyed. But if it's also neutral towards those goals, because it happens to be on a topic that doesn't really relate to equity, inclusion, and anti-racism goals, then that is his research. And to artificially pin it in advance to a particular goal is, once again, the imposition of a certain dogmatic view on the scientific endeavor. And while that's only in the social sciences, there's apparently a recent American Association of University Professors survey found that DEI criteria are included in consideration for tenure at 21.5% of colleges and universities and at 45.6% of large institutions of higher education. So you have all sorts of these watchdog groups that tried to protect free speech on campus and the like. So they did these studies and procured these statistics, which suggests that, again, even within the sciences, instead of the original creed, which was follow the evidence wherever it may lead, it's now tied to particular goals. And however noble those goals may be, it's important to recognize that this is no longer the pure scientific endeavor of seeking evidence, following evidence, and yielding the conclusions of that evidence. But I can just kindly ask everybody on Zoom to please mute. That would be very greatly appreciated. Thank you so much. So that is science as faith. Now, where the problems lie for us are when the claims of science or the term science is used to justify all sorts of claims that don't fit within the purview of science itself. In other words, you have people who I would call practitioners of the faith of science, who talk about what science tells us about all sorts of different things that really have very little to do with what science as a discipline actually tells us. And this is not a new phenomenon. I'm fond of a passage from Fyodor Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground. Notes from the Underground is Dostoevsky's most important short work. He's mostly known for his four longer novels, and they were very, very long. That's where he made his primary literary impact. But he had a number of shorter works as well, the most significant of which is widely considered to be Notes from the Underground. This came out in 1864. And there's a passage in Notes from Underground where Dostoevsky writes about those who speak in the name of the laws of nature and the deductions of natural science and mathematics. And he quips as follows. He says facetiously, as soon as they prove to you, for instance, that you are descended from a monkey, there is no use scowling, accept it for a fact. And then here's the critical passage for us. When they prove to you that in reality, one drop of your own fat must be dearer to you than 100,000 of your fellow creations, and that this conclusion is the final solution of all so-called virtues and duties and all such prejudices and fancies, then you have just to accept it. There is no help for it. For twice two is a law of mathematics. Just try refuting it. What Dostoevsky is facetiously pointing to is this assertion that you can draw all sorts of moral conclusions, and he's obviously using a particularly egregious moral conclusion by way of demonstration in order to demonstrate the absurdity of the premise. But all sorts of absurd moral conclusions are projected in the name of science. And just like mathematics tells us that 2 plus 2 is 4, and it's a refutable fact, it's the truth of the universe, it's the truth of the mathematical system, you can't, by the same token, all sorts of much broader moral calculations or moral decisions are a function of science itself, and there is no use disputing it. It is as established fact as 2 plus 2 or 2 times 2 is 4. And I think you've seen that only increase in contemporary society and in the modern world. I'm going to draw a few examples, 4 examples to be precise, most of which derive from one particular person. And I'll say who it is. It's a public figure, and he certainly has no qualms with taking issue with religious belief and the like. And I think he is perhaps one of the best examples of somebody who is a great practitioner of science as faith, and a very poor practitioner of science as discipline. And that is the popular science educator named Bill Nye. I don't know how many of you know Bill Nye. Bill Nye, he was the science. I grew up watching him as the science guy, and I loved the show. So this is really not personal. I really frankly enjoyed the show a lot as a kid. And again, it's not personal at all. I've never met the man. He could be a lovely guy. I do think, as you'll see in a moment, I think he's guilty of great intellectual hubris. And I don't think he's particularly good at seriously considering views beyond his own. And one might argue that that's a moral failing in addition to just intellectual failing. But beyond that, I have nothing against him personally. It's quite possible that he's a lovely man. No, I'm serious. I'm not here to take personal beef here. And I also want to mention that I don't want to talk about the issues themselves. We're going to see how he marshals science to talk about several contemporary issues within the current, what you might call culture wars, within the contemporary political sphere. And my goal is not to debate those issues themselves. Each of these issues is a worthwhile topic in its own right, and that some of them we have spoken about already. Some of them we can potentially speak about in future occasions. But I don't want to get mired in the issues. What I want to focus on is how the word science is being used to weigh in on these issues. And I want us to think critically for a moment as to whether there's actually a scientific view on these issues, whether there's a scientific view being expressed here, or whether that word is artificially being used to add credence and to add gravity to a personal opinion that is being expressed on far broader moral issues. Let's take a look at some of the issues that he weighs in on. So there was a video published by Big Think. I really know very little about the organization. It was a video that was put on the internet in September of 2015 on the topic of abortion. Now, abortion is, of course, a notoriously complex moral question. It's something that we actually discussed last year. We noted that within halakha, there's a range within the poskim. On the polar ends, you have Rav Moshe Feinstein on one end, you have Rav Waldenberg that sits Eliezer on the other end, and you have a lot in between as well. So again, this is not the occasion to talk about the issue itself. What I want to think about is how the word science is used to justify certain views. So Nye, when he talks about the issue, he begins with certain scientific facts. He talks about how an egg is fertilized, how it attaches to the uterine wall, the very high percentage of early miscarriages. I don't think people often realize just what a high percentage there is of early miscarriages, etc. And there he talks about science, but then he goes on to say certain things like the following: those who oppose abortion reflect a deep scientific lack of understanding. He says to his imaginary opponents, "You literally don't know what you're talking about." And then the most egregious quote is the following. Sorry, I'm just quoting directly, and I apologize if it offends anyone, it offends me, but I'm just going to quote from the quote itself. "Sorry, guys, I know it was written, or your interpretation of a book written 5,000 years ago, 50 centuries ago, makes you think that when a man and woman have sexual intercourse, they always have a baby. That's wrong. To pass laws based on that belief is inconsistent with nature." And then he adds, "It's hard not to get frustrated with this. It's very frustrating on the other side." Now, I would just note that at the very least, the frustration is mutual. I mean, when I hear a quote like this, I get very frustrated as well. Beyond the elementary mistakes, the fact that the Bible, by all accounts, was not written 5,000 years ago. Whenever you think the Bible was written, nobody thinks it was written 5,000 years ago. That's obviously just a silly mistake. We don't need to nitpick on those kinds of things. But the comment itself is just dripping with condescension, dripping with self-righteousness, and doesn't bother to actually take seriously the very serious moral questions that people raise in this very fraught issue pertaining to abortion. First of all, again, the treatment of the Bible is comical. Nobody thinks when reading the Bible that a man and woman, every time they have sexual intercourse, always have a baby. You only need to read about the infertility that our imahos faced. Our matriarchs all faced infertility problems. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel. So even just again, you don't need to be a Bible expert. You don't need to be a Talmud Chacham. Just a basic reading of the Bible betrays that's not really a misconception that anyone has. But two, you again have this marshaling of science to talk about an issue that is a fraught moral question. Science can establish many, many facts regarding embryology, regarding, again, how an egg is fertilized, attachments to the uterine wall, the various stages of development. There are lots of important facts that science has that can weigh in on this conversation. But ultimately, there are very important legal and moral questions that one needs to raise. We know that if you want to do it from a secular standpoint, our Declaration of Independence declares that every human being has an inalienable right. All men are created equal. We all have certain inalienable rights. And the first of them is a right to life. When does that right to life begin? That is a hard question to answer. And science can't really tell you when the right to life begins. Again, it could give us important benchmarks. It could tell us when a fetal heartbeat begins. It could tell us what the point of viability is. It could tell us statements about neural functioning. There's a lot of important facts that science can tell us, but it can't in and of itself weigh in on when the right to life begins. Of course, when we expand that to a broader moral question or spiritual question, the way we would put it is, at what point is there a neshama? Is a neshama present in this developing embryo? And once again, that's quite evidently not a question that science can weigh in on. If you want to strip it of its religious language, at what point is there murder? Is there life that needs to be protected? These are weighty and heady moral questions that science can't answer by itself. And yet you have this notion that science tells us what the answer is. And anyone who opposes that is some backwards Neanderthal who just doesn't understand the contemporary science, doesn't understand established scientific fact. I think it's just also important to note here, and this is also something, again, that's very common in the discourse, is that lots of times proponents of the ideology will be very aggressive in their attacks, and one needs to be very wary of that. I remember something that I was taught. It was in Dr. David Berger's course, one of the courses that I took with him, where he said that some academics write as if anyone who disagrees with their view is at best ill-informed or at worst somehow handicapped in terms of their ability to process. I think it was something to that effect, if I'm doing it justice. Okay, right, exactly. So I'll update it for 2023, but that they are somehow handicapped in their ability to process the world around them. And you have to be very careful in separating the strength of arguments, the actual strength and merits of an argument, with the tone with which the argument is promulgated. Just because someone talks like you're an idiot who doesn't understand scientific fact, if you adopt a view that's not my own, that doesn't mean it's not the case. And that's frequently the way it works. Going back to Plantinga for a moment, he talks about what are called the four horsemen of new atheism. New atheism, again, is a particular school of contemporary atheism. I don't want to get into all the nuances here, but there are four particularly vocal spokespeople for this new ideology. They call themselves, and they are often referred to as the four horsemen, again, invoking religious language to a large degree, of new atheism. And he writes as follows. The four horsemen also claim that religious belief is unreasonable and irrational, as silly as believing in the spaghetti monster or Superman, or maybe even the Green Lantern. I don't know why he has to take a shot at the Green Lantern, but okay. Their claims are loud and strident. They propose to deal with their opponents not by way of reasoned argument and discussion, but by way of ridicule and, quote, naked contempt. That's a quote from them. Why they choose this route is not wholly clear. He offers a couple of options, but he notes, in terms of intellectual competence, the new atheists are certainly inferior to the old atheists. Bertrand Russell and John Mackey, J.L. Mackey, come to mind. They are also inferior to many other contemporary but less strident atheists, Thomas Nagel, Michael Tooley, and William Rowe, for example. We may perhaps hope that the new atheists are but a temporary blemish on the face of serious conversation in this crucial area. Very frequently, the mode of attack is just abject ridicule. You are stupid if you believe. You're not complex. You're not sophisticated. You can't really process the world around you. And again, we need to be able to recognize that just insults are not science itself. And we should not cower in the face of those insults. Let me give you a couple of other examples. In another instance, Bill Nye weighed in on questions of gender. He had a TV series called Bill Nye Saves the World, I told you there's a little bit of self-enamor there. You know, that the title was Bill Nye Saves the World. It came out in 2017. And he spoke about gender. And he spoke about how we've discovered scientifically that there is a gender spectrum as opposed to old school, old fashioned gender binarism. It's not men and women. It's not male and female. There's a whole spectrum of gender. Now, again, I don't want to weigh in on this issue per se. I just want to like assess how he's using science in this conversation. He once again begins with certain scientific facts. He often begins with scientific facts pertaining to chromosomes. We used to think that was only XX and XY, XX being female, XY being male. He notes that there are exceptions, Klinefelter syndrome, where you have XXY, and there are other combinations that exist. That's not a particularly new discovery. But then he goes on to say that gender is indeed a spectrum. And he says, quote, sure, this might be confusing for those who insist everyone pick an M or an F. But people, we have to listen to the science. And the science says we're all on a spectrum. Now, again, I, without weighing in on the issue itself, let's just comment or note the usage of science here. If you're akin with one of the most basic tenets of contemporary gender ideology, if you'd speak to people who advocate for the view that gender is a spectrum, they would tell you, why is gender a spectrum? Because gender is a, two keywords, is a social construct, is a social construct. In other words, yes, there are certain biological facts that are determined at birth. But all the associations that we make with it, that little boys should play with trucks and little girls should play with dolls and blue and pink and all the broader associations that we have in terms of clothing choices, in terms of hobbies, in terms of games, all those things are purely social constructs. They're purely constructed artificially by human society and human culture. Now, once you argue that something is a social construct, you can no longer claim what? You can no longer claim that science has anything to tell us about it. That, again, this is not weighing in on what the true answer is. Is gender a social construct or is it not? If you're going to adopt the view that it is a social construct, you can't then come along and say, we have to listen to the science, and the science says we're all on a spectrum. It's just purely incorrect. And once again, you have an artificial usage of this term science to justify views that aren't rooted in science itself. Let me give you one more from Bill Nye, and then what I perceive to be the most significant. One more is on climate change. So in 2016, there was an interview done by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Again, I confess, I know very little about the organization, but I did watch the interview where Bill Nye was open to, expressed a willingness to imprison those who challenge climate change. Climate skeptics should potentially face jail time. The question that was given to him was a real layup. They quoted a public figure, a politician, who described climate skeptics as war criminals. Now, again, war criminals are the people who engage in mass murder and things like that. Anybody who's a climate skeptic is a war criminal. And the question that was posed to Nye was, has some of the rhetoric been too heated? Should we just really been calming down the rhetoric? That's a layup. That's an easy question to answer. The answer is, yeah, that's a little bit much. Now, I still think climate skepticism is bad because of A, B, C, D, and E. But yeah, we shouldn't be calling them war criminals. But that wasn't the answer he gave. He said, let's see what happens. For me as a taxpayer and voter, the introduction of this extreme doubt about climate change is affecting my quality of life as a public citizen. So I can see where people are very concerned about this and are pursuing criminal investigations as well as engaging in discussions like this. In other words, pursuing criminal investigations is valid for people who challenge the climate consensus. Now, here, I'm not going to get into First Amendment freedom of speech issues. I think, again, if you have a sensitivity to First Amendment in this country and the importance of freedom of speech, then you'll that itself will inform your response to this assertion. But let me just view it from a scientific standpoint. Here, he doesn't invoke the word science overtly. But think about this notion from the standpoint of a scientist. And here, I don't mean a practitioner of scientific faith. I mean a real scientist. The assertion here is that those who challenge the scientific consensus should be jailed, should be imprisoned. Let me ask you a question. What do you think Galileo would think of that assertion? How would Galileo like that idea, that if you challenge the scientific consensus, then somehow you face jail? A scientist would say, we should combat those who challenge the consensus with facts, with evidence. There are always going to be some people that we can't convince, but reasonable people will be convinced by the weight of the evidence that's on our side. But a religious fanatic says, let's jail the people who challenge the views that don't agree with our own. And again, I think it's just very frequently exemplified by those who are proponents of this ideology. Which brings us, of course, to the most significant claim. Scientific claim that God does not exist, Rahmanul Itzlan. I don't believe in God, I believe in science. But what about that argument? Now, I will say that I've never heard Bill Nye say that. From my experience, when he discusses the question of the existence of God, he does exhibit a bit more restraint and a bit more responsibility on the issue. But can one really claim that science denies the existence of God? To me, the answer is quite obviously not. The scope of science is to determine, is to study and to examine the natural world and natural phenomenon, and by definition, physical phenomena. And it does that to great effect, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. But it can't really make a statement about the existence of a non-physical entity, the most important non-physical entity, like God. Indeed, science can be an important source of faith. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And some of the greatest scientists through history were men of faith. Isaac Newton was a devout Christian. Contemporary skeptics will say, oh, had he not been Christian, he would have been an even greater physicist than he was. It was his Christianity that held him back and only made him one of the top two physicists in history. He would have been greater than Einstein. Again, I think that's remarkably self-serving. Newton was a devout Christian, and he saw his exploration of the physical universe as an expression of his religious belief. Einstein had some belief. I don't want to overstate our claims here. Sometimes people say Einstein was a theist. He did believe in some form of God, but it is not what we believe to be God. In other words, it's not the one true God. He had some spiritual beliefs, but he certainly did identify as a spiritual person. He believed in the God of Spinoza, whatever that means, a kind of pantheistic ideology. He was somebody who believed. And perhaps most surprisingly, people don't realize that Charles Darwin, when he first promulgated the theory of evolution, was a believer. Later, he left his religious beliefs due to the problem of evil and particular manifestations of the problem of evil that he discovered as a naturalist. But this is, again, a really interesting piece. I'm going to read to you the final passage of the theory of the origin of species. The theory of the origin of species was, of course, Darwin's landmark paper where he introduced to the world this theory of evolution. The final passage in that book says as follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator. Creator is written with a capital C, into a few forms or into one. And that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. In other words, it's so inspiring, Darwin says, that God created one form of life. This is, of course, again, the central theory of evolution. God breathed life into one being. And from that being, over the course of a very lengthy evolutionary process, you have this remarkable biodiversity that we witness today, a remarkable diversity of life. When contemporary proponents of what I'm calling scientific faith quote this passage, they replace that part about breathed by the Creator with dot, dot, dot. They replace it with an ellipsis. You can see instances where, again, they don't want to acknowledge that Darwin, at least at the outset, was a believer. So they replace it with, again, it's an act of censorship. They put the dot, 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 the ellipsis, in order to replace the Creator. But science cannot assert that God does not exist. And when we are told that science tells us, Rahman al-Itlan, that there is no Ribono Shalom, we need to be able to call that out for what it is. Ultimately, the ramifications of these expansions of science, rather than just scientific discipline, expansions to scientific belief, there are two significant ramifications of it. Number one, it's bad for science. It's bad for science. Very often, these self-same proponents of this worldview will be flabbergasted by the fact that there are so many people who deny scientific fact. Bill Nye gets very agitated when people deny the greenhouse gas effect. The greenhouse gas effect is an established fact of science. It's been demonstrated in laboratories. It's been witnessed on Venus. The greenhouse gas effect is real. What are its ramifications for our broader climate? Not entirely clear, and I don't say that out of a climate skepticism. If you asked a climatologist, they would tell you, we don't know exactly. Climatology is not physics, where we know an exact answer. There's a range of possibilities. And what should our answer be on a policy level? Obviously, politicians will debate that from here until Ad Yemos HaMashiach. But why do people deny the greenhouse gas effect in its entirety? And the answer is because when you make all sorts of absurd claims in the name of science, people lose the ability to distinguish between scientific fact and what I'll call scientific fiction, between what is actually something proven by a scientist in a laboratory and between what a spokesperson for science is claiming in the name of science, which has nothing to do with science. In one interview he wrote, he said, I know people are now critical of the expression fact-based, but what's wrong with that? The answer is there's nothing wrong with something being fact-based. But when you claim that all sorts of absurd things are fact-based, you lose the ability to distinguish fact from fiction entirely. And the term fact-based is used to support all sorts of views that have nothing to do with the facts that are purportedly supporting them, are purportedly backing up that worldview. And of course, more significantly for us, it's not just bad for science, it's bad for Torah as well. Which brings me back to my original story. Is scientific atheism our modern form of Avodah Zarah, such that when people perceive it without the ability, without the nuance to distinguish science as a discipline from the broader claims of science, it is that great temptation that draws us away from our fealty to the Ribono Shel Olam? And look, I'm not prepared to say on a halachic level that scientific atheism is Avodah Zarah, but I do think that it bears many commonalities with it. When I would speak to my high school students and they would express how baffled they were by this temptation, this perennial temptation that Klal Yisrael always had to do Avodah Zarah, you learn Sefer Shoftim, and they're constantly running back to Avodah Zarah, and they just say, what is it about these guys? Why are they constantly running back to Avodah Zarah? I would often tell them, and I don't know this to be true, but I think it is likely true, that just as you are baffled by their temptation to Avodah Zarah, the ancients would be entirely baffled by your temptation to atheism. Why is atheism so tempting? Why are people constantly struggling with their beliefs because of atheism? That's the dominant alternative ideology of the day. Same way Avodah Zarah was the alternative ideology back then. And again, they also bear certain broader similarities in terms of their outlook on the world. Avodah Zarah was never an ideology of surrender to a higher power, the way Torah requires us to surrender our will to the will of the Ribono Shel Olam. Avodah Zarah was a means of control. There's a natural world around us. There are all sorts of unpredictable factors in the world around us. There are all sorts of things that we can't control. So you know what we're going to do? There's going to be a whole host of deities and a whole host of rites that we can use to, in essence, control those deities in order to give us some measure of control over the world around us. And science does something similar. I think science as a discipline does it far more effectively than Avodah Zarah used to in terms of giving us an ability to control the world around us in a way that we were unable to previously. But it, once again, is that means of imposing order on the unordered. It's a means of imposing our control on a world beyond our control. And that has a very powerful appeal. And that means that our mission is to make sure that we are indeed able to separate those fact from fiction, scientific discipline from scientific faith, scientific fact from scientific imagination in defense of our beliefs. I would suggest that our community, and by our community, I mean the broader, whatever you call the modern Orthodox, YU community, OU community, we are uniquely equipped to respond to this challenge to Emunah in our day. If you take a community that doesn't really understand science at all, neither science as discipline nor science as faith, you're never going to be properly equipped to distinguish between the two, and you're never going to understand how to properly respond. When you take a community that does understand science and does appreciate science and openly acknowledges science, teaches science, appreciates its religious and spiritual value, then we are the ones who are uniquely equipped to address this major challenge to faith, which is one of the, again, great challenges to Emunah, to faith in God and religious practice in our time. Science as a discipline could be a great source of faith. Intellectually speaking, some of the most significant philosophical arguments for existence of God come from science. The argument that they call the fine-tuning of the universe, the mere fact that the universe is in existence from a scientific standpoint, the logistical probability of it is infinitesimally small. What they call the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics and the natural sciences. There are many intellectual arguments for faith based in science. Emotionally, it could be a very powerful source of faith as well. I'm very fond of the Rambam in Hilchos Sotei HaTorah in the second parak, where he says, if you want to understand what is Ahavas Hashem, he says Ahavas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, you want to know how to achieve that? The Rambam says, go study God's creation. Look at the natural world around you. It's just majestic. It's remarkable. Again, it's almost, he shares the great love of the natural universe that a true scientist shares. You look at it and it's just overwhelming in its majesty and its beauty, in its size and magnitude. And you're overwhelmed by that experience and it brings you closer to your creator. Proper science can be a motivator of faith as long as we're able to separate it from what is often spoken in its name. And I'll close with a quote from Rav Soloveitchik, or a quote that was made to the Reitz Rabbinic alumni in 1975. He said, we must not yield. I mean, emotionally, it is very important. We must not feel inferior. experience or develop an inferiority complex. And because of that complex, yield to the charm. Usually it is a transient and passing charm of modern political or ideological slogans. We should never cede our emotional confidence, our emotional stance when it comes to our fealty to Armasoro. I say not only not to compromise, certainly not to compromise, but even not to yield emotionally, not to feel inferior, not to experience an inferiority complex. And it should never occur to me that it is important if we would cooperate just a little bit with the modern trend or with the secular modern philosophy. The Rav argued it's not important just to hold our line on the issues, but to maintain our confidence in our stances and our confidence in our beliefs, to not yield before the bullying pressure of those who tell us that our view is antiquated, that we are somehow mentally incapacitated, that we're ancient, that we're Neanderthals, that we haven't kept up with the times. Because it is not true. Our values are eternal. They are timeless. If they were true thousands of years ago, I assure you they are just as true today. And we need to make sure that we are always ready and vigilant in expressing our belief in them and in defending them to those who would challenge them. As we approach our Zman Matan Torosenu, the anniversary of our acceptance of the Torah, let us accept upon ourselves to reinvigorate ourselves in that acceptance of Torah and to make sure that those values that we indeed accepted thousands of years ago continue to animate our lives in all facets today and that we are always ready to live by them and defend them to others.
I was hoping for a